by cautious words from the man who 20 years before had taken the leadership of the fort from him. Hawksworth Hale said slowly, "Hughie, your family and mine have always loved these islands. We cannot stand by and see them suffer any further." The big man looked in dismay at his leader and was about to reject the proposals, but Hale reasoned, "If we must live with labor, and that seems to be the spirit of the times, let's do so with a certain grace. I'm going to call Sakagawa back and make the best." "I do not wish to be present," Jander said abruptly. He started to leave the room by the back door, but paused to warn his associates. "You're turning these islands over to the communists. I refuse to watch a Japanese field hand come stomping into my office to lay down..." "But you will consider yourself bound by our decision?" Hale interrupted. "Yes," Jander snapped grudgingly. And when Goro returned to ratify the mutual surrender, Hewlett Janders was not there. When the great strike ended, three of Hale's plantation managers, men senior to himself, quit with these words, "We've been doing things our own way too long to be told by a bunch of slant-eyed Japs how to raise sugar." Younger men stepped forward to take their places, and it was a rueful moment when Hale discovered that he did not even know two of the replacements. And before the year ended, the new overseers were reporting, "We can work with the new system. Looks like we'll make more sugar than before." Hughie Janders snorted. "Something is eroding the character of America when young men are so eager to compromise with evil." And then Hughie made his point. At a meeting of the fort, he rushed in with the news that one of the lesser communists had broken with Rod Burke and had signified his willingness to identify both Burke and his wife as card-carrying members of the Communist Party. This caused a flurry of excitement, which a series of substantiating phone calls raised to fever pitch. "I knew the whole lot of them were communists," Hughie cried triumphantly. "To think that we allowed Goro Sakagawa to come stomping into this office." "I don't believe he's charged," Hale cautioned. "At least when I called Jasper, he didn't." "They're all communists," Hughie warned. "I told you a year ago that Rod Burke was a Red, and he was. I tell you now that Goro Sakagawa is a Red, and he is." John Whipple Hawksworth said icily, "Let's wait till they're indicted, then apply all our strength until they're convicted." "Has anybody called the governor?" Janders asked. "Not yet," John Whipple replied. "I'd love to," Janders gloated. "Last time I saw him about communism, he said..." "Nobody will call anybody," Hale interrupted. "A great thing has happened in our favor. Nobody must spoil it." And the fort studied carefully how the new developments could be used to its advantage. But the day's triumph was somewhat dampened by an assistant's report that, while everyone's attention had been focused on the strike, something curious seemed to have been happening, something which he was unable to explain. Producing a map of downtown Honolulu, he pointed to certain areas hatched in red and explained, "This is the Rafer Hawksworth building, and the ground floor has been leased to a Japanese named Fujimoto. Nothing suspicious about that. He has the big dry goods store in Kaimuki. Now, this area is the restaurant whose building is owned by Ed Hewlett's widow. It's been leased to a Filipino who runs a restaurant in Wahaiwa." "What are you driving at, Charlie?" Hawksworth asked impatiently. "Look," the assistant cried. "Within the past 6 months, every store in this block has been leased, except the big Joe Janders holding. Do you see what that means?" Quiet descended over the fort as the managers studied the map. Finally, Hawksworth said, "If somebody has been leasing these sites under an assumed name..." This ugly suspicion circulated, but it was soon stopped by robust Hewlett Janders, who said gruffly, "Hell, what are you worrying about? I've warned Cousin Joe 100 times never to lease his building without clearing things with me. As long as he holds fast, there's not going to be any trouble. What could a person do with just these little... Call Joe, Hawksworth said imperatively. An ominous silence surrounded Bluff Hewlett as he cried warmly, Hello, Joe. This is Huey. Joe, you haven't leased your big store site, have you? There was a ghastly silence, and Hewlett Janders, completely shaken, put down the phone. There was no cause to ask him what had happened. The news stood out from his sagging round face. God damn, Hawksworth Hale shouted, banging the table. We've been outsmarted. Who did this? He raged. Hewlett, who leased that store? Big Hewlett Janders kept his head down, staring at the table. I'm ashamed to say, Kamajiro Sakagawa. We'll break him, Hawksworth stormed. We'll not bring a single cargo of his into Honolulu. That man will starve on... Icy John Whipple Hawksworth was speaking. The problem is twofold. Who engineered this damnable thing, and for whom? There was long discussion as to who could have accumulated enough capital and wisdom to have effected such a coup, and by a slow process of elimination, all came to agree that only Hong Kong Key could have swung it. I'll challenge him right now, Hawksworth cried, and in a forthright manner he phoned Hong Kong and asked, Did you buy up all the leases? When the Chinese banker replied, Hawksworth nodded his head to his associates. Whom were you representing, Hong Kong? This time, Hawksworth did not move his head, but listened in stunned silence. Thank you, Hong Kong, he said, and put down the phone. California fruit? Janders asked. Gregory's, Hale replied. There was an aching, dumb silence as an era came to an end. Finally, one of the Hawksworths asked, Can't we fight this in the courts? I don't think so, Hale answered. Surely we could get Judge Harper to issue an injunction on one of these leases. He's married to my cousin, and I could explain... If Hong Kong Key arranged those leases... Hale could not go on. He dropped his head into his hands, thought for a long time, and then asked his associates, How could these people do this to us? Your family, Whipple, why, they looked after the keys. Damn it, the whole Key Hui got its start with that land old Doc gave them. And those damned Sakagawas. Imagine Kamajiro showing such ingratitude, buying leases behind our backs. How do you explain it? You'd think they'd feel some kind of loyalty to us. We brought them here, gave them land, looked after them when they were so damned poor they couldn't read or write. What's happening in the world when such people turn against you? That's what McLafferty's been doing, Janders shouted. He threw us off the track, talking about that hotel. Hale now had control of himself and said, Gentlemen, this is the beginning of an endless fight. I personally am going to obstruct Gregory's and McLafferty at every turn. Not to keep them out of the islands, because if Hong Kong arranged the leases, they'll stand up in court. One of the Hawksworths interrupted. You'd think that in view of all we've done for Judge Harper, we could at least rely on him to void one of the leases. Hale ignored this stupid and unworthy observation, continuing, We must fight for time. We'll establish branches of our own stores in Waikiki, in Wailea, and across the Pali. Every one of you who controls a going concern, move a branch out into the suburbs. Multiply and tie everything up. By the time Gregory's get here, we'll have our stores so prosperous they'll die on the vine. So, in the curious way by which a deadly catfish, when thrown into a pool of trout, eats a few of the lazy fish, but inspires the others to greater exertion, so that in the end there are more trout, and better, and all because of the evil catfish. The arrival of Gregory's into Hawaii, followed by California fruit and Shea and Horner, drove the Hawaiian economy ahead by such spurts that soon the fort was much better off than it had been before. In the same obtuse way, the increased wages that Goro Sakagawa's union had chiseled out of the fort really made that establishment richer than ever, because much of the money filtered back into its enterprises, and the general prosperity of the islands multiplied. Hale's determination to fight the mainland intruders with increased economic energy of his own had one unforeseen effect upon Hawaii, and in subsequent years this was often cited as the real revolution of that trying age. If the fort was going to compete on an equal footing with outfits like Gregory's, it could no longer afford to promote into top positions inadequate nephews and cousins and gutless second sons. So, under Hawksworth Hale's sharp eye, a good many Hales and Hawksworths and Janderses and Hewletts were weeded out. His policy was forthright. Either give them minor jobs where they can't wreck the system, or give them substantial shares of stock on which they can live while real men run the companies. As a result, what crude Hewlett Janders called the chinless wonders found themselves with a lot of stock, a good yearly income, and freedom to live either in France or Havana, while in their places appeared a flood of smart young graduates of the Wharton School, Stanford, and Harvard Business. Some, out of sheer prudence, married Whipple girls or Hales or Hewletts, but most brought their own wives in from the mainland, and all Hawaii prospered. But of the men who dominated the fort, only shrewd, confused Hawksworth Hale, alternately fighting and surrendering, saw what the real menace of those days was. It was not the arrival of Gregory's, nauseating though that was, nor the triumph of the Unions, seditious as that was. It lay in the fact that Black Jim McLafferty was a Democrat. His legal residence was now Hawaii. He no longer worked for Gregory's, but had a small law practice of his own, which he combined with politicking. And whenever Hawksworth Hale passed McLafferty's office, he studied the door with foreboding, for he knew that, in the long run, Democrats were worse than Gregory's or Unions or Communists. He was therefore appalled one morning when he saw that McLafferty's door carried a new sign, McLafferty and Sakagawa. Shigeo was back from Harvard, an expert on land reform, a brilliant legalist, and, thanks to Black Jim McLafferty's foresight, an official Democrat. Following the strike, two of the main protagonists were taken out of circulation by family problems, and for some time not much was heard of either Goro Sakagawa or Hawksworth Hale. At first, it looked as if the former's troubles were the greater, for from that day in late 1945, when Goro had first met the slim and intense young Tokyo Moden, Akemi-san, their lives had been continuously complicated. First had come harassment by MPs who had tried to enforce the no-fraternization edict of the occupation, and it had been unpleasant to be dating a girl you loved when the MPs had the right to intrude at any moment. Next had been the ridiculous difficulty faced by any American soldier who wanted to marry a Japanese girl. So that once Goro had remarked bitterly, "When good things are being passed out, they never consider me an American. But when they're dishing out the misery, I'm one of the finest Americans on record." The young lovers had evaded the anti-marriage edict by engineering a Shinto wedding at a shrine near the edge of Tokyo, and had later discovered that Goro couldn't bring a Shinto bride back to America, so there had been renewed humiliation at the consul's office. But in those trying periods, Akemi-san had proved herself a stalwart girl with a saving sense of humor, and largely because she was so sweet to officialdom, her paperwork was ultimately completed, and by special connivance, she found herself free to enter Hawaii. In 1946, when the troop transport neared Honolulu, Akemi-san had been one of the most practical-minded brides aboard, suffering from few of the illusions whose shattering would mar the first days in America for many of the other girls. She had not been bedazzled by her young American, Goro Sakagawa. She had recognized that he was what Modens called a peasant type, stubborn, imperfectly educated, and boorish. And even in the starving days when he had had access to the mammoth PXs that blossomed across Japan, where his military pay had made him a millionaire compared to the Japanese, she had known that he was not a rich man. Furthermore, she had been specifically warned by friends who knew others who had lived in Hawaii that the islands were populated mostly by Hiroshima-ken people who were clannish to a fault and not altogether contemporary. One lively Tokyo girl had whispered to her, "I've been to Hawaii. In the entire area, not one moden." Akemi had no illusions about her new home. But even so, she was not prepared for what faced her. At the dock, she was met by Mr. Sakagawa and his son-in-law, Mr. Ishii, with their wives standing stolidly behind the stocky little men. And she thought, this is the way families used to look in Japan 30 years ago. However, she took an instant liking to bulldog little Sakagawa-san with his arms hanging out from knees, and thought, as she looked down at him, he is like my father. But then she saw grim-faced Mrs. Sakagawa, iron-willed and conservative, and she shivered, thinking to herself, she's the one to fear. She's the kind we had to fight against in Tokyo. She was right. Mrs. Sakagawa never eased up. Gentle with her husband, she was a terror to her daughter-in-law. Long ago in Hiroshima, when a son brought home a wife to work the rice fields, it was his mother's responsibility to see that the girl was soon and ably whipped into the habits of a good farm wife. And Mrs. Sakagawa proposed to perform this task for Goro. In fact, as soon as she saw Akemi at the railing of the ship, she realized that Goro had made a sad choice. For she whispered contemptuously to her daughter Reiko, "She looks like a city girl, and you know what expensive habits they have." If Goro had had a well-paying job which permitted him to live away from home, things might have settled down to a mutual and smoldering disapproval, in which the two women saw each other as little as possible, and were then studiously polite for the sake of Goro. But this could not be. For Goro's salary at the union did not permit him to have his own home, so he stayed with his parents. Early in her battle to subdue Akemi, Mrs. Sakagawa established her theme. "When I came to Hawaii, life was very difficult, and there is no reason why you should be pampered." "Does she expect me to go out and chop a few fields of sugar each afternoon?" Akemi asked Goro one night. And in time, he began to hate coming home, for each of his women would in turn try to grab him off to some corner to explain the faults of the other and the turmoil of that day. What angered Akemi most was a little thing, yet so recurrent that it began eroding her happiness with Goro. The Sakagawas had not spoken the best Japanese even while growing up in Hiroshima, and their long imprisonment in Hawaii had positively corrupted their speech, so that they now used many Hawaiian, Chinese, Haole, and Filipino words, with a lilting melody to their speech borrowed from the Mexican. Much of their phraseology was incomprehensible to Akemi, but she said nothing, and would have been polite enough never to have commented on this to the Sakagawas. For, as she told another war bride whom she met at the store, "I find their horrible speech rather amusing." And the two girls had laughed pleasantly together. The Sakagawas were not so considerate. They found Akemi's precise Japanese, with its careful inflections and pronunciations, infuriating. "She thinks she's better than we are," Mrs. Sakagawa stormed one night at Goro, "always talking as if her mouth were full of beans which she didn't want to bite." Often, when the family was gathered for evening meal, Akemi would make some casual observation, and Mrs. Sakagawa would repeat one or two words, pronouncing them in the barbarous Hawaiian manner. Then everyone would laugh at Akemi, and she would blush. She fell into the habit of waiting at the market till one or another of the war brides came in, and hungrily, like refugees in an alien land, they would talk with each other in fine Japanese without fear of being ridiculed. "It's like living in Japan 100 years ago," Akemi said angrily one day. Then she broke into tears. and when the other girl handed her a mirror so that she could make up her face and be presentable, she looked at herself a long time and said, "Fumiko, would you think that I had once been the leader of the Modens? I love Bruckner and Brahms. I was fighting to set the Japanese girl free. Now I'm in a worse prison than any of them, and do you know why it's worse? Because it's all so horribly ugly. Ugly houses, ugly speech, ugly thoughts. Fumiko, I haven't been to a concert or a play in over a year. Nobody I know except you has ever heard of André Gide. I think we've made a terrible mistake." Later, when alone at the Sakagawas, she thought, "I live for the few minutes I can talk with a sensible human being, but every time I do, I feel worse than before." One night she said forcefully, "Goro, there's an orchestra concert tonight, and I think we should go." Awkwardly, they went. But she did not enjoy it because Goro felt ill at ease, and the entire audience, except for a few students, were howlers. "Don't the Japanese ever go to plays or music?" she asked. But he interpreted this as the beginning edge of a complaint, so he mumbled, "We're busy working." "For what?" she snapped. And he said nothing. When Akemi next met Fumiko at the market, she asked, "What is it they're working for?" "In Japan, a man and woman will work like idiots to get tickets for the theater or to buy a beautiful ceramic. What do they work for here? I'll tell you what for, so that they can buy a big black automobile and put the old mama-san in the back and drive around Honolulu and say, 'Now I am as good as a haole.' I'm ashamed whenever I see Japanese doctors and lawyers in their big black automobiles." "I am too," Fumiko confessed. "To think that they surrendered everything Japanese for such a set of values." Things got a little better when Shigeo returned from Harvard with his honors degree in law, for then Akemi had an intelligent person with whom she could talk, and they had long discussions on politics and art. Akemi was astonished to find that Shig had been to visit the museums in Boston, but he explained, "I'd never have gone on my own account, but I was living with Dr. Abernethy and his wife, and they said that any Sunday on which you didn't do something to improve your mind was a Sunday wasted, and I had a great time with them." "Tell me about the Boston Symphony," Akemi pleaded. "In Japan, we think it's one of the best." At this point, shrewd Mrs. Sakagawa took Shigeo aside and said, "You must not talk any more with Akemi-san. She is your brother's wife, and not a good girl at all, and she will try to make you fall in love with her, and then we will have a tragedy in the family. I told both you and Goro that you ought to avoid city girls, but neither of you would listen, and now see what's happened." "What has happened?" Shigeo asked. "Goro has been trapped by a vain and silly girl," his mother explained. "Music, books, plays all day long. She wants to talk about politics. She is no good, that one." The reasons his mother gave did not impress Shigeo, but the fact that Akemi was temptingly beautiful in her soft Japanese way did, and he stopped being alone with her, so that her life became even more desperate than before. It was rescued by the arrival one day of a young sociologist from the University.